So today it's a metaphysics of the act. Next week we're going to, or week 9th of February, we'll look at the existence of God and arguments in for the existence of God in Nyaya and Shaiva schools. And then we're going to look at implicit metaphysics in the Natra Tantra, and then finally non-dualist metaphysics. In my case, we're moving from ignorance to a bit more knowledge, but Mimamsa often is neglected, so I often think it's interesting to look at Mimamsa, and I often wonder if things had turned out differently, if there was a different emphasis in our study of Indian philosophy, if we might have a slightly different picture of it, because we get the Vedanta gets emphasised, and the Mimamsa gets neglected, it seems to me. So Fritz Stahl once made an interesting point that the Romantics discovered Indian thinking from the Western perspective, and so saw Indian philosophy through the lens of Romanticism, and so it was all about thought and longing for the infinite and all this sort of thing. Whereas China got discovered by Western philosophers later, he argues, and so they saw there empiricism and science and solid 19th century kind of things. And I thought that was interesting. So if it had been the other way around, if they had discovered Indian metaphysics later, perhaps there wouldn't be such an emphasis on thinking and thought and idealism, but more an emphasis on action and things like the Vaisheshikas and so on. So I thought, anyway, just a thought-provoking idea that Stahl had. So metaphysical thinking in India. So today we're going to have an introduction and look at this, the idea of metaphysics of the act in the Mimamsakas. So I'll talk for about 30-35 minutes, and then we'll have a discussion. Now, Avicenna was an Islamic philosopher who was the most important commentator on Aristotle. So anyway, Avicenna, who was probably the most important commentator on Aristotle, says that metaphysics has three features. First of all, it's an immaterial science. Secondly, it's concerned with natural causes, and it's concerned with first philosophy as the first cause of the whole. So his question was, what's the intellectual object of metaphysics? And he says, well, actually, it can't be God, because God exceeds the boundaries of being an object. So it must be secondary causes, he says. But then he does later on bring God back in. So anyway, if these are the concerns of metaphysics, then India is certainly concerned with these things. So the history of metaphysical thinking in India is analogous to this way of thinking. So there's no Sanskrit word, to my knowledge anyway, I can't think of one, that directly translates metaphysics. Indian philosophy expressed through the medium of Sanskrit, along with pre-philosophical scriptures and commentaries, has nevertheless been deeply concerned with metaphysics throughout its history. So there are similar problems addressed in other civilizations, in China, India, and the West, that are parallel, that are analogous to each other. So I'm just going to look at India in these four classes. So the purpose of these lectures is to lay out some of the positions of this variable metaphysical landscape, taking concrete examples from the philosophical situation in the medieval period in India. What it is to be a person, the ontological status of the world, the existence of God, what it is to lead a good life. So these very fundamental basic ideas. So India did not explicitly or thematically make the Greek distinction between logos and mythos, not explicitly anyway, reason and story. But nevertheless, it did hold reason to be a way of knowing, and rational arguments between the schools were undertaken mostly in the form of commentaries on scriptures, a mode of inquiry similar to scholasticism in medieval Europe. So you've got these parallel developments of scholastic philosophy. So just raising the question whether India had the distinction between reason and story, mythos and logos. I don't think it ever made that explicitly the way that the Greeks did. But nevertheless, it is there implicitly, I think. And there are parallels between scholasticism and in medieval Europe and the Indic traditions. So in these lectures, I want to focus on the idea of the human self as a central theme in relation to the idea of transcendence, along with the soteriological understanding of the human person that addresses questions about the predominance of either action or cognition and knowledge, and what the essence of a person really is. These were the concerns of India. Different systems had distinct views about the nature of the self, and how the broader metaphysical question about whether reality comprises the unity of a single substance or a pluralism of distinct substances impacted upon that question. So although it's difficult to incontrovertibly establish the history of philosophical texts, there are philosophical themes in the very early literature of the founding revelation, the Rig Veda. And there's that famous hymn, which I've got in the footnote there, about the, what was the beginning of all this? Footnote 3, Stephanie Jameson's translation there. The non-existence did not exist prior, nor did the existent at that time. So it's all full of paradox. This was a terrific hymn. There existed neither the airy space nor the heaven beyond. What moved back and forth from where and in whose protection? Did water exist, a deep depth, this creation, from where it came to be, if it was produced or if not? He who is the overseer of this world in the furthest heaven, he surely knows, or if he does not know. You've got the text there for you Sanskrit enthusiasts. You can read that. So a very early metaphysical speculation. Now, apart from the paradoxical idea of there being nothing, this suggests that the ontological question about the relation of being to nothing was posited at the very foundation of Indian philosophy in this pre-philosophical text in the Rig Veda. And it might be the case that Heidegger's claim that the ancient Greeks raised the ontological question, the question of the being of beings, could also be applied to this ancient Indic source. So the questioning theme is also taken up by the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the esoteric treatise of the sage with the white mule, which opens with several speculative metaphysical questions about the nature of time, the cause of an absolute power, the foundation on which the world is established. So note 5, this is Olival's translation. People who make inquiries into Brahman about Brahman say, what is the cause of Brahman? Why were we born? By what do we live? On what are we established? Governed by whom? O you who know Brahman, do we live in pleasure and pain, each in our respective situation? Should we regard it as time, as inherent nature, as chance, as the elements, as the source of birth, or as the person, or a combination of these? So it's, again, interesting speculation in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, although probably quite late. It's probably about 2nd century CE, they think, Obelis thinks, the Shvetashvatara, because it's got doctrines of the Pashupatas, and it's post-Bhagavad Gita. We know it's post-Bhagavad Gita. So the last verse, you've got Bhakti and Prasada in there, Bhakti and Grace. But it does raise this very interesting, it's clearly a metaphysical, clearly a text about metaphysics in the very early period. Now, by the early medieval period, then, religions focus on Shiva and Vishnu. I don't want to do an introduction to Hinduism, but they and the goddess had arisen and were well developed by this time. And so disciplines arose to preserve and understand Vedic texts and the ritual practices such as the limbs of the Veda. And a large literature developed that focuses on ritual action from early Vedic texts to ritual manuals, the padatis of the medieval period. And this emphasis on action in the Brahmanical imagination led to the development of the school of Vedic exegesis, the Mimamsa. So a focus on action rather than thought. And I think this has been underestimated and is really important. which present a philosophy of action rather than a school focus on, or rather a school focus on the language of the Veda and what it and what we would call hermeneutics. So it's not action directly, it's indirect action. So it's focus on the language of the Veda, but the Veda tells us how to act. So that's so it's in action is, if you like, the secondary object, as I'll talk about in a minute. So there are two groups of ancient texts, as you know, focused on ritual, the Shrauta rites that the Mimamsa is concerned about, and the Griha rites that Padati literature is concerned about, as Christoph Zotter shows in some of his work. Now, orthopraxy rather than orthodoxy is more important, where the sections on ritual action, Karma Kanda, and the ritual manual is important. And I think Christoph Zotter, that Heidelberg scholar, is very good on all this, very interesting work he does on the emphasis on action in the ritual tradition, early ritual tradition. So Mimamsa is arguably a philosophy of action. For the Mimamsa, there are perhaps two significant features of human reality. We speak, we use language, and we act. Action is a distinctive human feature, more important than cognition, because action has consequence in the world. You can think what you like, but it's what you do that makes a difference to anything. Above all, as human beings, we need to be concerned with action as enjoined by the scriptural revelation, and so we must be concerned with ritual action. The ritual act for the Mimamsa, namely sacrifice, and that's what they mean by ritual action, they mean sacrifice, is performed not to achieve a specific purpose, such as going to heaven at death, well, that's a secondary consequence, but because it's enjoined by scripture. The Mimamsa is thus a reflection not so much on ritual per se, but on the nature of Vedic language. So it focuses on Vedic language. Vedic language tells you how to perform rituals or what to do, what not to do. One of the consequences of going to heaven, that's fine, but you don't do it because of that. You do it because the scripture tells you to do it. So action is a kind of indirect object, if you like. So as human beings, we need to be concerned with action as enjoined by scriptural revelation. So we should act in conformity to dharma, which is truth or duty. And the founding text of the school, if you know, the Mimamsa Sutra, opens with the statement, now the inquiry into dharma. So we must perform ritual action because of vidhi, injunction, and these injunctive sections of the text have greater importance than other statements that simply commend those injunctions. So the Mimamsa is primarily the study of Vedic texts and the science of language to discern the meaning of the unauthored, infallible body of injunctions and prohibitions. Jim Benson's terrific introduction, I think, to his text Mahadeva Vedantin's Mimamsa Nyaya Sangraha, the compendium of the principles of the Mimamsa, is a great introduction to the Mimamsa, and I'd highly recommend it. That must be one of the most significant publications in the field, I should think, actually, although it's a late text, but it's a great way in. So much Mimamsa literature, such as Mahadeva Vedantin's ritual manual that Jim edited and translated, is concerned with precise ritual detail and correct procedure rather than abstract speculation. So here's an example. In the injunction to sacrifice a cow entails that a goat is not sacrificed. If it says you sacrifice a cow, it means you don't sacrifice a goat. I think it's important for them. At 10:229 it says, at the statement, this is Jim's translation, he should offer, i.e. kill, a milk cow for Dyava Prithvi, a calf for the Maruts, and a bull for Indra, etc. The words Denu, etc. denote respectively an animal that has recently given birth, a young animal, and a male animal, and so the goat is not blocked. But no, says the Mahadeva Vedantin, because they denote these features only as occurring in a cow, and therefore one should not operate properly without blocking the... Sorry, therefore one should not operate properly without blocking the goat. The goat is blocked, i.e. So you've got to get it right. These are ritual details. So it says you've got to offer a cow, not a goat. So you offer a cow. And why is it important? It's important because it's injunction, because it's vidhi. If there's anything important in life, it's getting these details correct. It's the precision of correct performance, correct action. So we need to pay attention to detail, and to do what is required, which remains sufficient for the performance of correct action. Just doing what is required by the text is sufficient for the performance of correct action. So interesting ethical issues too. In this philosophy, we're not defined by abstract purpose, but by our correct ritual procedure. Does this indicate what is involved in the ritual is not what it means or even what it enjoins, such as heaven, but rather how it's performed or the assurance that it has been performed correctly? So what matters here is the correct performance. You do you kill a cow, not a goat. And you do it in a certain way. You perform the ritual correctly. And you do it not to go to heaven, but because Scripture enjoins it. Scripture says you should do it that way. Now, what is of note is that sacrifice here, the enjoined ritual par excellence, is not classed as violence. So the Mimamsaka has got a lot of flack from the kind of from the Buddhists, from the Shramana traditions. About killing these animals, it's killing. And I said, oh, no, it's not killing. It's, the Shramanas have got it wrong. They put it in a different category. Wilhelm Fuss wrote an interesting article on that. So it's not violence according to the Mimamsa. And it's here where a recognizable metaphysics comes into view. The performance of sacrifice produces a transcendent power, a purva, which produces the results of the sacrifice, particularly heaven after death, rather than liberation, moksha, somewhat akin to the idea of accumulated merit as the result of good action. So apurva is a force that operates only within a single lifetime, the accumulation of sacrificial merit for the sacrificial patron. So the person who paid for the sacrifice gets this merit, gets this apurva. And the implications of this for understanding the self are that sacrifice is metaphysically significant and points to the nature of a person as formed through action. We are constructed through ritual act, and indeed, this is substantiated in common Hindu notion of the rites of passage or samskaras, in which the person is formed from birth to death. So samskara, the rites of passage, means put together, construct the person through life. But what about the permanent Atman then? How does that square with that? So you've got both. So although samskara is that which is made or put together or constructed, yet the destiny of the metaphysical principle underlying that construction is the Atman, is the self, the life essence that continues after the cremation of the body, after the last sacrifice, the antyeshti. And that's determined by ritual action. So while the later tradition accepted reincarnation, this seems to be absent from the Mimamsa's origin, where there is a sense of continuity into the realm of the ancestors, into the Pitris, but not a return to the world, at least in that early text. I'm happy to be corrected on that, but I think that's the case. And although heaven may be a consequence of sacrifice, this is not why we perform it. Rather, we perform ritual act not to go to heaven, but simply because it is injunction, Vedic injunction. And so is a good in itself. And so it might be seen as a kind of celebration. Perhaps I'm exaggerating there, but the ritual act in itself is a good, is an inherent good. And it might be understood in terms of celebration. Celebration of the act itself, kind of the pure act. So the purest kind of act is the ritual act, and it's an inherent good. So this philosophy of ritual action presents the human person in a distinct light, it seems to me. Human desires and purposes are quite irrelevant to the performance of ritual, for it's it for it is the injunction that counts, quite regardless of personal desire or even intention. There's a decentering of the human, to use Cluny's term, such that the objectivity of sacrificial ritual takes precedence over any personal reward. And so only Brahmins can perform it. Women, lower classes and imbeciles, it says, are forbidden from participating in this pure ritual act. The ritual itself almost has an ontology that takes precedence over performer, who must be defined in terms of his suitability, adhikara, to perform the rite. So you have to have the right adhikara, the right suitability. And the idea of a human purpose, of purusharta, the human purposes, is superseded by the idea of a sacrificial purpose, the kratvarta, the arta, the purpose of the kratu, of the sacrifice. Which is, what is the purpose of sacrifice? The purpose of the sacrifice is the pure act for its own sake, because it's enjoined by scripture. It's not for the sake of something else. Although you go to heaven, that's not why you do it. The importance of the Mimamsa insight, then, is perhaps being underestimated in the histories of Indian philosophy, as this is the clear articulation of sacrificial religion that was arguably the core practice through the medieval kingdoms, to their demise with the ascendancy of the Delhi Sultanate and the Mughals and the British. So, it could, I mean, I don't know, I haven't done the work, but it's not for me to do, but somebody to do. It could be that the Mimamsa is the core philosophical tradition, the core articulation of the fundamental state religion, which was based on sacrifice, right the way through, state-sponsored religion, right the way through to its demise. So the Vedic sacrifice gets transformed into tantric sacrifice, which is the central religion, central ritual act of the of the state religion, Shaivism, down to the 13th century. And then it all... Then once you've got the destruction of the state, you get the destruction of the sacrifice, basically. And also the marginalisation of the intellectual articulation of the ritual act, the Mimamsa. So because of the emphasis on Dharma, the philosophy of correct ritual action, the Mimamsa extended their inquiry to other areas of philosophical concern, especially language. And through analysing the sentence and arguing for its syntactic unity, completed by the expectancy of the reader, the Mimamsa philosophers showed how Vedic injunction functions and how sacrificial purpose impacts upon a human community of qualified practitioners, those who've got the adhikara, those who've got the ability to perform the rite. So related to the analysis of language or epistemological questions, and the Mimamsa accepted all six traditional modes of knowledge, you know, the pramanas, to establish the reality of the world, and so rejects the idealism of the rival traditions, particularly the Yogacara Buddhism. For the Mimamsa, the world is real, and objects of knowledge can be known through the means of knowledge, through the means of knowing them, because they contain substance, dravya, quality, action, and non-existence, the possibility of non-existence, along with subcategories which aligns the school with other major realist schools, with the other major realist school, the Vaisheshika. So this decentering of the human and the privileging of impersonal sacrificial act at the fundamental of revealed injunction becomes overlaid in the history of philosophy by other discourses that, in complete contrast, put the self at the centre of philosophical concern. So there's a shift from the centre of philosophical concern is the language of the Veda and the sacrifice and getting it right, which is pure action, action for its own sake, so thereby subordinating human desires to the objectivity of injunction. That gets replaced with an emphasis on the self. I mean, I know the notion of the self is goes back very ancient times, but in terms of emphasis, in terms of philosophical emphasis, and the predominance of which tradition is, predominant. So, the later Mimamsa or Vedanta, by contrast, claimed the exact opposite, that it's the self that's important and not the action. So Shankara privileges the Upanishads and the Jnana Kanda over the ritual sections. It's not what you do that's important, it's your cognition and what you think, and what, and or perhaps not so much what you think, but your realization, your turning around of your consciousness to realize you, that you are the absolute. That so it's a different, it's your, almost the opposite of the Mimamsa, and yet it's called the Uttara Mimamsa, the later Mimamsa. So the later Mimamsa or Vedanta did that. So, okay then, let's look at this notion, let's look a bit more, we've got a few more minutes, on the Mimamsa as a tradition, as a discipline. If Mimamsa is a discipline, a way of looking at texts, what is it? What is the method? And the method is reason, as all these Indian philosophical traditions were. But the interesting question is, what is its object? What's the intellectual object of the Mimamsa? And it's Vedic language, and injunction, and so action. So I've got a little diagram there. If the method is reason, the intellectual object for the Mimamsa is firstly Vedic language, and secondly, human action. Because Vedic language is about human action, because it tells you what to do and what not to do. And the result of that ritual act is nothing, i.e. you act because of injunction, because it's a pure act, it's action for its own sake. Or the Mimamsas accepted this, but they didn't think it was the reason why you do ritual, you go to heaven. So heaven is a consequence of pure action, pure good action, but it's not why you do it. You do it because of injunction. So I think there are two intellectual objects, the direct intellectual object of Vedic language and the indirect one of ritual act. And both of these say something about what it is to be a human being. Now, studying Mimamsa, if Western scholarship has understood India in terms of its own interests, thus Romanticism finds parallels in Indian metaphysics, so Coleridge is interested in German idealism, and he goes over to Germany and studies with all these, the Schlegels and all that, and Wordsworth, Tintern Abbey, they don't find any parallels in the Mimamsaka tradition, but they find parallels in the Uttara Vedanta, the Uttara Mimamsa, the later Vedanta tradition. And Montecil Duperron's Latin translation of the Oop neck hat, the Persian translation of the Upanishads, was to influence philosophers such as Schopenhauer in 1814. He said that was the greatest book that's ever been written, which led to the 20th century concerns with India as mystical, like we get in Hermann Hesse. Oh, I like Hermann Hesse. And an emphasis on the mind or consciousness that has meant that we've neglected the importance of the ritual tradition. And we've been neglected, partly because India neglected it itself, because with the demise of the Hindu, what we might call the Hindu kingdoms by the 13th century, the ritual tradition gets marginalised. There's a story about Schopenhauer? He's just coming to my mind. Obit annus, abit onus. The old woman is dead, the burden is lifted, he says. He wrote that in his accounts, because he went into rages, and his cleaner was cleaning outside this room, and he burst into a rage and told her to stop making such a noise and pushed her down the stairs. And the poor lady took him to court. She went to the magistrates, and the magistrate ordered that he should pay her a pension for the rest of her life, and she lived for another 20 years. So he wrote that in his accounts. The old lady is dead, the burden is lifted. Dear, dear. But it's a funny play on the Latin, isn't it? Anyway. So perhaps we projected a kind of mind-body dualism onto the history of India, with an emphasis on the mind, to the neglect of human action. But arguably, the historical reality is much more complex in the history of Indian metaphysics and action. What we do has been neglected in favour of an emphasis on what we think. and sacrifice as the foundation of the history of Indian thinking about the nature of the world. It's also we've underestimated the importance of sacrifice as the foundation of the history of Indian thinking about the nature of the world, God and human beings. And the Mimamsa is a mainstream orthodox form of philosophy that reflects upon sacrifice. And that leads in, perhaps, to the Tantric revelation. So that's arguably, then, by way of conclusion, with the Mimamsa, we got a philosophy of action which says, what's the most important human... Later traditions emphasised, what is a person? A person acts, a person wills, and a person thinks. Those are the categories in later Indian thinking. In contrast to, say, the 18th century, where you've got, in the West, Europe, you've got a person wills, a person thinks, and a person feels. So you've got, India doesn't have feeling as a category in that classification, but it's got action. And there's been an emphasis on thinking, but perhaps to the neglect of an emphasis on action, which, according to the Mimamsa, is the most important feature of what we do, of what we are as human beings. We act. And what's the quintessential human action? It's ritual, it's sacrifice. Sacrifice is the quintessential human action because it's enjoined by the Veda. Well, they didn't want to think too deeply about it. Why do we do this? Oh, we do it because it says that in the text. We do that because it's revelation. But what's the next step? Would be, well, why do that? Why do what the Vedas say? So then you become a non-Mimamsaka once you raise that question, I guess. You become a Buddhist or something. So by way of, that's all. So by way of summary, then, I'm just thinking that that the Mimamsakas, there's a great neglect of action, and there's Indian philosophy is arguably founded on action, and sacrifice is the central ritual act, and then it becomes a central metaphor. Look at the Mahabharata, it's a great sacrifice. The Bhagavad Gita is pervaded with the image of sacrifice. And renunciation is allied to sacrifice. So there's this. Renunciation is the other side of the coin. So you've got sacrifice, renunciation. They go together. So the internalization of the sacrifice in the Upanishads is a different kind of sacrifice. It's kind of internalization of sacrifice. So sacrifice never goes away in the history of India, and is arguably the central state religion up until the 13th century, reflected upon by the Mimamsakas, and then just preserved now in pockets on the margins, like Kerala, like Bali, like Nepal. So various questions that we can look at. Is this metaphysics? Is the Mimamsa thing, you've got to sacrifice a cow, not a goat. Is that metaphysics? Why does the Mimamsa become eclipsed by the later Vedanta? Why does it become eclipsed? What happens there? Do they intellectually win? Presumably it's to do with patronage. Is Apurva the origin of karma? Or the Mimamsa version of the Shramana, of a Shramana idea, or neither? So karma's ancient, but I don't know the earliest accounts of Apurva. But anyway, it's interesting. Is that a kind of Mimamsa version of karma? Why does attention shift in the history of thought from the purpose or telos of sacrifice to the purpose or telos of the human, from the Kratvarta to the Purusharta? Why does that shift occur? So these are some of the questions, I think, which are unanswered that would be interesting to talk about.